Talking with Kevin Sheridan and Steve Smerd, right? On 20th August 1975 at the San Diego meeting of the AAS. We're going to do a joint discussion here of early CSIRO days. So let me start off with you, Steve. When did you first get involved in radio astronomy?
I first became involved in 1947. During the Second World War, well, after I got my degree, I worked with the British Admiralty on radar. And after the war, I looked for peacetime occupation, and the CSIR, as it was then called, advertised attractive positions, and I got one of those.
You were in England then, right?
Yes, I was in England during the Second World War, and joined CSIR in about May 46, and first worked on millimeter wave generators. They had a lab which held it up for a little while, and I transferred to the radio astronomy group, and more specifically, solid radio astronomy. And
what was going on when you joined the group there?
At that stage, they had discovered that the meter wavelength radiation from the sun was sufficiently strong so that if it was attributed to thermal radiation from the Deccan corona, it must be something like a million degree corona.
Right.
They all had a number of burst like quartz, and they had located by seeing geometry some of the sources of these bursts as coming both from strong sunspot regions on the sun, and some of the strongest bursts came from were associated with optical flare events.
Let me just ask, was this C interferometric technique, which was taken over from shipboard radar, as other people have told me, was that also done in the British Navy, or was that that technique of getting the reflected wave?
I didn't know it was taken over from shipboard methods. You might know that, Kevin.
I think, as far as radar was concerned, it was an undesirable consequence to get ground reflection, but I don't know.
But couldn't you make use of it also, though?
You could, yes.
To get the elevation of the plane.
Right, but they didn't tell you very much about those things in those days, because all that was classified, I suppose they did.
That's what I've been told by a couple of people.
I don't know whether it's been published.
I haven't heard.
But Fuzzy and
McCready,
Payne Scott,
I think, were the ones who went in for the interferometry.
Right,
to locate these sources. They took their own observations.
I think they studied it initially from optics, the equipment of what, Lloyd Mirror, wasn't
the Lloyd
it?
Right, right.
But they did have access to lots of radar information, so they made which one couldn't avoid in radar and ground reflection.
So what did you first work on in the solar work?
Joe Coulson and asked me to familiarize myself with the sun. I had no idea. I knew it was there and the heat rays and light. We were very lucky in Australia, I think, as far as radio astronomy is concerned, because one of the top optical astronomers, Gary Allen, unlike many optical astronomers around the world, took radio astronomy very seriously, and right from the beginning. And he cooperated with Joe Hosey and the radio astronomers very closely. And so I went down to Stromlo for a few weeks.
I see.
Okay, Alan familiarized me with the sun. He gave me lots of things to read and talked with him a lot. And after that was largely perhaps a matter of trying to build up a sort of density temperature type of picture of the sun, making uniform models, realizing that non-uniformities existed, introducing magnetic fields, and gradually worked towards working out the expected Bremsstrahlung radio emissions from the sun, and then later on taking magnetic fields into account to work out how much polarization you would expect and how this could be detected, say, during eclipses when one portion of the sun might be obscured.
Right. Let me ask, how did you happen to get into the theoretical models? Your background had been in equipment, had it not?
Not entirely, no. During the war, I had worked a little bit in connection with the theoretical group on Professor Hartley of Manchester, who tried to figure out the theory of the magnetron, which was the heart of the radar sets. and I was involved.
I see.
In my work with Edmund, I was involved in the theory and practice of scaling magnetrons to for different wavelengths.
I see.
That's the type of thing that I was doing there. So I had a little bit of theoretical background, but nothing really to do with science. And I worked fairly closely together with Kevin Westphal at that time. We developed sort of the theory of the emission and absorption as it applies to radio frequency radiation from a thermal plasma.
Right, and this culminated in a paper in 1950 or 51,
I think. 49, I think we had a joint paper on the radio emissions from a plasma. General theory, and then that went over, and I sort of took that over into the Quiet Sun.
Now, you were describing this paper.
Right, and then led on to the Quiet Sun work, and also the effect of magnetic fields on the equalization of the thermal emission, and some unpublished papers which were based on, I think, one of the first computer applications. We had a team of Maston Beer and Trevor Pearcey, who constructed one of the first electronic computers in our laboratory. At the time it filled a room, I think, the size of a small library.
Right, all tubes. And
Yes.
1,607, I think.
And one of the first programs they did was modeling this quiet sun work, which we put in such a form that one could readily change, say, the density and temperature scales.
And when was this now? When you were doing this?
In the early 50s sometime, I think.
Kevin Westphal is always referring to Steve in those days as the unpublished papers of Steve Smith.
Yeah, well, it was the most interesting work to do. I didn't always get down to that and things like that.
Right. Well, let's switch over to you now. When did you first come in contact with radio astronomy, Kevin?
About 1953, when Bernie Moore was just starting off a model of his cross. We had a field station at Pottsville, a little suburb of Sydney.
Right.
And Alec Little had made a model of the cross, and I was doing Bernie Moore's at that time, and Alec was able to show that technically it worked okay. Bernie and Alec proved all the features of it, and then the next step was building the 85.5 megahertz, the 85 megahertz cross at a new field station on the site called Fleurus.
But let me ask, what were you doing before you got in?
I was doing radio edge to navigation.
At CSIRO?
CSIRO, that's right. We had more or less finished that. They were looking for some technical help in the projects. So I helped Bernie and Alec with the main cross at first, and then later Alec Shane, who was also a radio astronomer, he did a lot of early work on the sun at a site at Hornsby. So Alec
did the low frequency
work on the sun about 10 megahertz. Names like Higgins, Shane and Higgins,
right.
That Shane. He got interested in making a cross for low frequency observations, and so he also set up a cross at this Fleurus field station at 19.7 megahertz. And I helped him a little bit on that. Then I transferred over to Paul Wild in about 1955 or 1956, and they had, Paul had his spectrograph working at DAPTA, another station, and he had already derived all of his solar types and a tremendous amount of initial original work on solar bursts, and they were looking for help in constructing the swept frequency interferometer to locate the positions of the bursts. So I helped him with that, and also extending the range of the radio spectrograph in frequency. Initially it used to go from 40 to 210, I think, from 40 to 210. So we finished up adding bands till finally we were limited by the ionosphere at the lower end.
Mm-hmm.
at Ducktower, I think we finished up at 220 or something that it used to. No, sorry, we went first of all from 5 to 220, and then Dr. Suzuki, who had joined us from Japan.
Suzuki, you said?
Suzuki, yes. He joined us and designed a broadband spectrograph receiver, which was actually the first of its kind in radio astronomy. It covered a 10-to-1 frequency range, and that, in those days we used to be happy if we could get 2-to-1 frequency range. So this was a big step, because it enabled us to go from 200 to 2000 in one sweep. So at that day,
this is at what time now when he was working on this?
Well, that was in the 1957s, I suppose, 58, when we had called. So by the time at 1960, I think we were sweeping from 5 to 2,000 megs.
A little bit
and we had
the
swept frequency interferometer going from 40 to 70.
40 to 70 swept frequency, right?
That's about that time Paul was getting interested in heliographs.
Well, before we get into that, what other groups, were there any other comparable swept frequency receivers over such a range at that time?
People in those days had spectrographs covering certain ranges. Alan Maxwell had his one,
At Fort Davis?
Fort Davis and Fred Haddock in Michigan.
Fred Haddock in Michigan and other
airborne instruments.
I think around about that time, Regima, is it, or somebody by that name, from
Finland,
designed the first of the electronically swept.
I see. What was his name again?
R-I-J-H-I-M-M-A, isn't it?
I think he worked with Alan for a while before he went back to Finland.
And where did he publish his stuff?
He published it in one of the American journals, I think. There are plenty of references to his work.
But I think at the time were there any other frequency swept interferometers?
Yes, the Tim Roberts has a group from Caltech, swept from 1,000 to 2,000, wasn't it? And opened up the decimeter range.
Yeah,
Alan Maxwell used to go up to 580, and then they jumped for some reason to 2,000 and swept to 4,000, and the range between 500 and 2,000 wasn't covered very well. I think Jim Roberts went maybe from 500 to 1,000 or 1,000 to 2,000, I can't remember. Again, that's...
They covered roughly 500 to 1,000, and I think the moving force behind it was Gail Walton.
He was a pusher.
I didn't realize that Caltech was in the solar...
They were when Jim Roberts went over there, Gail Morton
from Lockheed,
one of the drivers,
I think.
And about what time was this now?
That would have been
early 60s,
I think.
Oh, I see. So this is after Owens Valley was...
They just used one of the dishes of Owens Valley, and they had such tremendous collecting area.
I see.
20 dB attenuated in the aerial lead in order to keep it quiet. And Jim Roberts, and I'm saying Jim Roberts because I think he was the main person who analysed all the results and wrote up all the details. But he wasn't the first author on the paper.
I think was in there, young one, Spencer Wharton. Were there any other position locating instruments around at the time, like the 40 to 70? Would be paying Scott and Alec Little constructed a face weight
right.
To locate sources at one feet.
That was one of the first steps.
That was in the early 50s, and they located radio storms on a particular sort of large sunspots.
They invented the phase weight technique for this.
They did, in fact, sources. They had moving sources at 90 megahertz on their records, but did not give them a special name.
I see.
They talked about moving out first, so it was not until the early 50s.
We skipped that.
It was not until the French group in Verdun had a 169 megahertz in the front that they discovered that these moving sources were special types of events, which they called the moving type 4 bursts.
I see. Now, in the Payne, Scott, and Little, do they mention it in their paper, or are you just saying that when they look back and they're...
it is mentioned, I think, that some of these outbursts move, and they gave a description of how they move outwards and appear to move back in some cases.
I see.
This was a little before Paul had made all the classification of the types. Well, it was about that.
The types, I think, probably were known, and I think they... I'm not quite sure whether they talked about moving outbursts or whether they suggested that possibly some type 2s in particular might be moving.
I don't think that they mentioned type 1.
They did not. But that was pretty important.
That was 53 or so when those papers came out. Yeah.
That was a similar
I assumed, incidentally, that they would be talking to those sorts of people.
Oh, certainly, certainly. Yes, right. But I had another question before we get in.
So don't forget to include Ali Little.
He was going to be able to see him,
because he was a foundation member of quite a lot of these.
Right.
He worked his way up the hard way from the workshop through lab assistant that he's now associate professor.
Really?
He had to work hard for everything he got.
I had another question for you, or for both of you, really. Why was it that CSIRO is willing to support, to such a large extent, this pure research? Or was there motivation that the improvements in receivers and so forth might be beneficial? It was really quite a large effort.
It's a very tough question. And I think our division was regarded atypically of CSIRO, which is essentially, applied divisions at least. There are specific names for wool research and cattle dairy research, that type of thing, and also secondary industry, mineral chemistry, and all sorts of things. Ours was regarded as a little bit of a prestige division in the fundamental research line, although they realized that the possibility of a spin-off from development of these techniques would always be there for, say, civil aviation or possibly radar application, that type of thing. Also that they wanted possibly a pool of people who had worked on radar and, to continue on along these lines, just in case they might be needed at some stage or another, possibly to work again on more applied.
But do you think this was a primary reason? Or
The other thing was that under Joe Corsi, I think, this group had some outstanding individuals. As you know, people like Paul Wild probably developed the basic techniques of solar radio research and gave the basic interpretations, perhaps, most of the solar radio phenomena. And similarly, say, with Bolton discovering sources and Bernie Mills developing imaging device.
It looks such a promising thing that they decided to keep going.
International recognition to the extent that for the first time in its history, say, ERSI, for instance, the International Radio Science Union, held a meeting in the Southern Hemisphere in 1952. So as early as 1952,
right.
They had already established a bit of a reputation in that field.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
For instance, the fact that when Whitehead produced his series of the Sun and the Solar System, the books under his editorship, Corsi was asked for the line to provide half-year commissions. So I think the executive series all probably recognized that we had found international recognition during the first few years of the effort, and they were prepared perhaps to support this as long as...
So it was sort of a special case. I mean, would you say then that perhaps radio astronomy is the field in which Australia is, at least then, was most dominant in scientific research?
Well.
Is there any other field that...
It being a small country, obviously the scientific effort has to be heavily channeled into a few directions.
Right.
We can't love to, as the states do.
Right.
And apart from radio, in the physical sciences, I think radio astronomy and astronomy quite generally, both traditionally and also with these particular examples, has been a strong line in Australia. One reason, of course, has nothing to do with the sun, of course.
The southern hemisphere.
It's entirely due to Paul Wild's genius, I think. The fact that the southern hemisphere, but the sun can be seen, obviously, from other places too, occasionally, California.
Right.
So that I think, the fact that the solar group exists, and that this, in my opinion, is entirely due to the fact that Paul Wild, to me, is one of the few Peter, who is not a competent scientist, but a highly original scientist, which is very rare thing. Next to the first director, he can stimulate a group of 20 people to carry out a well-directed and good research by his bird's eye view of what one...
The record speaks for itself, right?
Yes. I think your record speaks for itself. But I think it was largely the success in the field, perhaps, which
I think self-generating
allowed us to continue.
That makes sense. Yeah.
The security of funding.
We had that pool of know-how just channel into this field and play it all straight away. And I guess
one thing
led to another, and it was
They started with single frequency recorders. We had seven single frequency recorders in the late 40s. Spreading from 60 megahertz, as far as I remember, up to 9,400 megahertz, which was a tremendous coverage with seven, single frequency receivers and chart records. And some of the features which showed up on these records gave Paul a clue, for instance, that there must be a number of bursts which occur near simultaneously over a wide meter wavelength range, others which are a systematic delay. And he realized then, for instance, that if we swept through that frequency range, we could pick up a sort of pattern recognition type of spectral identification of the fast drift burst, slow drift burst, the little blobby ones which don't drift at all, and continue, which fill the whole frequency range, say, and might drift in on slowly on one of hydrogen frequencies. So all this development that he initiated and saw through was all very logically based, and then he said, all right, let's locate these things, and that's how the 40 to 70 megahertz swept frequency interferometer, giving you one-dimensional locations. Well, from what we learned from the one-dimensional locations, which obviously always have the sort of nasty feature that you can say, all right, the source must lie somewhere along this line, and the sun is here, and the only thing you could do was to say, all right, if there's a flare here on the surface, we'll go perpendicular to this and say the radio source may be somewhere around here. But then eventually it became clear that radio sources simply aren't always radially above, say, a sort of flare.